So this is Groovy Tools, or having a groovy time at JCreet 2013. This is August 20th, and we are beginning. I don't know what Dimitri is saying, but yeah, you're welcome to stay, buddy. Okay. Good. So here in the room is Marcos and Stelius. Oh, I recognize that name from 300. Good, and myself, Andres Almeray. We'll see if somebody else shows up later. So when I posted the idea for this talk was have a chat of who is making use of Groovy by itself, or maybe some other tools. For example, there is this Gradle for build tool. There is a Spark for testing. There is also ECB for behavioral development. There is a fairly new micro web framework called Ratpack. So have you heard of Sinatra in Ruby?
Yeah, I heard, but not.
So the idea is that you define a simple script that in this script you define which are the basic routes for which the web server will react, and that's it. You get nothing more. There's nothing like Rails with active record and templates. That nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the minimal bare bones to get a simple web server, a web-based application working. Now the same thing happens in Ratpack. There is a play of words there because, well, Ruby has Sinatra, and we have the whole Ratpack, and it's written in Java and accommodates for a Groovy-based and a Java-based API, so you don't have to know Groovy to know to use it, but it will be good because the code, of course, is shorter. There are other Groovy tools that you can use in your daily work. I use the Groovy console almost every single day to try out some APIs that are maybe unknown to me. Also, that is my favorite regular expression tool. Whenever I need to test out a regular expression, I just open the Groovy console and do it, because regular expressions in Groovy are first-class citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easier to come up with a format for the regular expression in Groovy, and then you can, well, actually, if you copy that regular expression in Groovy, paste it in Java source using IntelliJ IDE, and you get the right escaped characters. Escape, you don't have to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You just paste it, and that's magic. And yeah, there may be others like benchmarking and helping with logging, and we could talk also about AST transformations and standard Java code bases, which may lead us eventually to Project Lombok or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, the point is to know what people are doing with Groovy, or if you are not using Groovy, well, showcase all the things that you can do so that maybe you will give it a try.
Yeah. So what I'm using, or it told yesterday, is Spock, and I dabbled a bit with Gradle, but not really in a productive project, and I was really impressed with the way, I think this is some kind of meta programming which they redefined these operators to facilitate this table input stuff and so on. I was always meaning to look into the source code of Spock to see how this stuff works.
I can tell you for one that I haven't really looked into the source code of Spock as well, but I know the author, and using a very rough comparison, what Spock does is it messages the bytecode, because what you write in a Spock test is not valid Groovy code.
Exactly.
It has really broken the syntax.
Yeah.
But the Spock is able to talk to the compiler using this feature called AST transformations,
yeah,
so that the generated bytecode is valid Ruby code. So it rearranges the source. Well, it rearranges.
But the classes themselves are compiled by the Ruby compiler, right?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
It's just that the Spark hookings into a specific phase of the compilation.
Yeah.
And then it rearranges the code in such a way that it's valid Ruby code, and then the compiler continues, and then everything works fine.
Okay.
So this is not to scare you away from Spark. It's just to say that Spark does some magical things behind the covers. So in the end result is that you're very expressive with what you write, and what you get in terms of behavior and bytecode is what
it
should be.
At first I thought it's just an internal DSL, and I said, oh, this is possible, this could be, I never knew. And then I somehow stopped at the point where I saw, there's some more magic than I can grok in just half an hour or so, just so it's looking at it.
So, I think I have an example of this, and with a Grails application. So Spark can be used with a standard Java project, standard Ruby project. There are plugins for other frameworks like Grails, like Griffon, that just makes it easier to integrate this thing, but you can do it manually. Spark can be used with Maven, with Gradle, with Ant. So there's no specific tight coupling with a single build tool. I think I have an example of a Grails app that uses Spark for both unit testing and functional testing. Unit testing is regular as any other unit testing, but what's great about Spark is that this has this feature called data tables. Now, data tables are what JUnit calls data providers. It's exactly the same thing. It's just that the syntax for Spark is much easier to comprehend and much easier to read and write than coming up with data providers in JUnit. Let's see, I think, see if there is an example here in the test unit. Here we have it. So what we're seeing here is a specification of a Grails service. This Grails service is a login service, and what it will do is figure out if a user and a password combination are the right ones. So if it's found in the database, perfect, you're logging, otherwise you cannot log in. Now this particular service has several implementations of the login service, the login feature, because I wanted to try out different ways of how you can do queries with Grails.
Yeah.
Anyway, the important thing about this test is that the first thing that you may notice here is the name of the method. The name of the method is a long string. Now that is weird. And turns out that the JVM supports this kind of methods. It's Java the language that does not. It's just Java the language, the syntax that does not. Also, the syntax of the Groovy language, which is very close to Java, does not allow this. So how come this can happen? Well, this is one of the things that Spark does, is make sure that you can do these things. The next thing we see is that the code is separated in several blocks. So there are labels. There are special labels set up, and there is an alias called given. We'll see that in a moment. Expect, where, there's also then, when, and so what happens, cleanup as a matter of fact too. What happens within those blocks is that each one of them has its own semantics, its own behavior. During the setup, it is expected that you initialize variables that will be needed for the duration of what we call here, we call feature methods. We don't call them tests. That's just how naming goes, but they're actually tests. So a setup block is akin to having defining a setup method in a JUnit test case. But the catch is that this setup block will only be called for this particular method, whereas in JUnit the setup will be called for every single test method that you write. So this is better scope in that sense. You could also have a setup for all methods that run for every instance. You just define a method name called setup. You can also have a setup for the whole class, so runs once, just call it setup spec. The same way you can clean up, you may have a cleanup block that's for only that guy, or cleanup method for everybody, or cleanup spec for the whole class. So we have all the bases covered. Next thing we see in this spec block, there is a variable there that we haven't defined it before, and these other two. And what we're reading here is user equals operator service do login with username and password. The user, username, and password variables have not been defined. What's going on here? Moreover, there is a comparison there with the equals operator, but nothing more. So if we do this in plain Java, well, that may evaluate to true, but and nothing happens, right? But in the spec, because we're within the spec block, it is assumed that every sentence that you write there is supposed to be an assertion. So if this is the same as if we have written assert in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So if this equals operator fails, then we will have a test failure. If it succeeds, mm-hmm. Well, then we're okay.
It does a very nice output then with these errors which go into exactly...
Yeah, the power search.
All have all substituted and it looks very nice. That's,
yeah, we'll see when we run. And then there is another block called the where block.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where this feature called the data table comes in. Mm-hmm. You can see that the first row consists of the name of those variables that we didn't define before, username, password, and user, each one separated by a pipe. So this is the OR operator, the logical OR. Again, this is not valid Groovy syntax. It cannot be. Mm-hmm. But then Spark messages the bytecode and makes sure that for each row that you see in this table, you get an instance of this feature method. So this table is actually 7 elements, 7 rows. This method will be run 7 times. Each time, the username, password, and user values will become from those rows. If we were to write this in JUnit, it would be more verbose.
But just to be clear, so the Ruby compilation process allows you to have a preprocessor, which, it's not valid Groovy syntax and it messages the bytecode. So does it message the source code, or is it... Is it the precompiler working on the source code, or is it
actually this is valid? This is valid source code.
Yeah,
but
it won't
compile to something that is logical.
Yeah, exactly.
So
Groovy compiler builds you the syntax tree, and then you can, which doesn't make any sense, which wouldn't.
Exactly. So you can build an abstract syntax tree based on this code, and if you let it continue, it will fail.
Okay.
And that's the moment, because the Groovy compiler has 9 different phases that the Spark hooks in right after you get the AST and makes sure that it rearranges it correctly. Broadly speaking.
Yeah, yeah. And you really have a nice API for the AST where you can such kind of stuff in a stable manner.
I'm used to the API, so I can say nice with air quotes.
Yeah.
There are some missing documentations there sometimes when you get in trouble. But most of the times, there's plenty of examples out there in case you want to get accustomed to this API. This is what we call AST transformations.
Yeah.
So if I run this method, it will actually be run 7 times because there are 7 rows. But there are also another thing that we see on the method name is the method name says attempting login with username colon username with a hash and password colon with password with a hash. These things that look like variables hash name will be actually translated using the values from the rows, because the whole class has been annotated with a special spec annotation called onRoll. If we don't have this onRoll thing, then there will be 7 iterations, but the name will be a generic name. I use an index so that you can know, this is the iteration number 2, number 3.
Mm-hmm.
But if I use onRoll, then I see these values being substituted.
Mm-hmm.
In the JUnit report and also on the IDE. So because this class has been annotated with those things, and I choose to just run this test method. Let's see, let's select this one. on this corner, when we see instantiating the test and idea, we should see seven methods. So it's taking a little bit for Grails to kickstart, because we had to run this thing with Grails. And I think that it's starting from a clean compilation. Unable to attach test report. So I got something wrong with IntelliJ IDEA. Let's try that again. If we run the whole login spec, we should get a lot of testing methods. Maybe I did something wrong with this setup. Let's see. Okay, now we see all those methods. And if you look at the method names, it says attempting login with username equals null, password null, and then username empty and password null, so following all the combinations. So that's pretty cool. There are other syntaxes for writing data tables. You can use the You can use the left shift operator, so that you can move values into a list and make that list the row or the different rows. You can also provide your own custom data provider, as long as the data provider implements or provides an iterator method. It doesn't have to implement iterable, but if it provides an iterator method, then you're good to go. So anything goes there. So in a sense, you could make a SQL query, return the result set, wrap it in some kind of iterator, and then hook it up as a data provider. You're good to go. Another test case is interesting, the functional test case. Makes use of another interesting feature, and here I would like your input, because every time that I ask this question, I get different answers. Functional testing, we know they are expensive. Thing is, it's expensive to set up a functional test, because we are testing the application from the view point of view, right? It's the real thing, so we're talking to the real database, the real components. So say that you have reached the homepage and you have asserted whatever you need to do so that you are in the right place. Now you click on the login link. Now you have to assert that you are in the login page. Then you enter the credentials and you make it fail so that you got the wrong credentials. And then you have to assert again that you're on the login page. And you enter the right credentials. If they are the right ones, then you should be on the welcome page or some other page, right? But every one of these steps builds up on the previous step. So you cannot be, or you cannot work on the login page if you haven't gone through the link of the login one. You cannot be on the welcome one if you were not previously on the login page and so forth. So what we usually do here is manually call the previous method, the testing method, that will set up that particular state, right? What Spark does, it has an annotation called stepwise. It does two things. First, it assures that method invocation happens in the order that you define in the source code, something that we cannot guarantee otherwise. And the next thing it does, it makes sure that the previous state is the input state for the next test. So these two things are supposed to be big no-nos.
What does we're testing. Previous state mean? It doesn't instantiate a new instance of the class, or
To be honest, I don't know how exactly it does it. If it doesn't instantiate a new version of the class, but it makes sure that the state of the last test that was run will be the starting state of the next one. So this is a big no-no for unit testing.
Yeah, of course. You have this with all testing frameworks and work around more or less successfully.
In the case of Spark, it's very easy, because you annotate the class, the main one, with stepwise like this. There's nothing more.
Yeah.
it will automatically do the right thing for you. Mm-hmm. So for this particular feature method, now we're following a kind of like a behavior-driven approach. It's just a matter of choosing the names for the blocks that are already available. So we're doing, we want saying given that we are in the index page. I'm making use of another Groovy tool called Jeff. It's a functional drive abstraction on top of WebDriver. Mm-hmm. So it uses the page model. You model what you want to have exposed in a particular page, mm-hmm. and only those things. We also make use of runtime metaprogramming and property access of for simple things like you define a text field with a particular ID, username, and there is no other HTML element that has that ID. Then if I have a page object from Jeff, I can grab a reference to that username just by saying page instance.username. Mm-hmm. There's nothing else. But if I have a series of buttons that they don't have an ID but may have a particular class, then I can use some kind of a jQuery style selector to find that HTML element.
Okay.
It is not jQuery, it's still Groovy code, but it parses the DOM generated by the browser so that it can locate the elements.
Okay.
It makes it easy.
So the runtime is some kind of Reno?
No, it's, well, so there's the, it, because it uses WebDriver,
mm-hmm.
It depends on which browser you're talking to.
Okay.
This particular version that I hook up, this particular version that I hook up uses HTML Unit, so it's a faceless web browser.
Yeah.
So what this guy is saying, given that I'm the index page, I expect that I am the index page, so I'm just sanity checked, so I'm really at the right place? Okay, perfect. Then this guy, the link, is actually some content exposed by this index page. We'll see how that is done. Now that I have located that link, I click on it. What I expect then is that I'll be at the login page. Okay, so if this is correct, when I finish this test, I'm at the login page. The next method says entering invalid credentials. And notice that there's no preview setup because we're already at the login page. That's a nice thing. So we set some properties, the username, password. The username and password are text fields that have a unique ID. Nobody else has those, so I can grab them directly as property access. Then locate some button, again, provided by the login page. Click on it. But then there should be an error because I have the wrong credentials. Here we have another, this end block is actually the same as an alias for the previous one. So it's this as saying then and then.
Mm-hmm.
Here's, we are applying a regular expression. As I said, we have first class citizen support for regular expressions. Mm-hmm. If this div somehow we located contains this kind of text, then we are okay. We are still at the login page. So the third method says entering correct credentials should return the welcome page. Okay, so we set up again, username, password, click the submit button, and now we should be at the welcome page. There is another page modeling this. And on that welcome page, we ask for the header h1 and see if the text contains something like that.
Mm-hmm.
How about that header h1 and first,
how do they provide? They are provided by the pages. So let's look at the login page. Here, login page extends from a base object called page,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to provide at least two metadata information.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
The static add property is how you say I'm at this place. You may use, may want to match the title or some other HTML element that you can have access to. And the other one is the static content. On the static content, you define a name. In this each one of these are closures. So this closure name, submit button. Inside that, I use something that looks like a jQuery selector. I'm looking for an element of type button whose name is submit. And here's the first error div. The jQuery selector is, I'm looking for a div element that has a CSS class called alert message.
Mm-hmm.
And this returns a list of elements because there may be many. I'm grabbing the first element.
Mm-hmm. And that at here try to, if you have multiple page, login page and forget password page, it is distinguished in at level of that ad.
Of that ad property, yes. For this particular case, I'm using the title because it's the simplest one, and I made sure that every page in this application has a different title.
But it is possible to get get that ad from location, not only from title. It's possible.
From the URL.
Yeah.
I think so, it's possible, and also you can use other HTML elements, so anything else that you have on the meta attributes, you can have.
But if it is possible to put in that place a regular expression?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, you, certainly you can.
Okay.
In this case I'm using the direct string, the whole thing, but you could use a regular expression.
Mm-hmm.
So if I run this, I'm hoping that it's working. The last time that I run it was okay. So let's go back into the login page, login spec, and run it. So let's select the login spec as a Grails test. This would take a little bit longer because being a functional test means it has to bootstrap the whole application. Now, Jeb has integration with JUnit, so you are not forced to use a Spark if you want to use Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
You can use it with plain Gradle or plain Maven.
Mm-hmm.
So you are not forced to use Grails. And we were in talks with the Archelion guys to see if there could be some kind of Jeff Archelion integration. Archelion is a framework for container-based testing, any kind of container. And they already have a functional testing thing based on WebDriver as well. But this thing, if you're into Groovy, then I think it would be nicer because it's shorter. Aha, I got an error here. So the first test was okay. And then entering invalid credentials results in error. And it turns out that the second test method is now wrong. Maybe something didn't run correctly, but it shows that because there was an error, the required content first error div, there's some error trying to look at the error div. So I maybe changed the HTML content. This goes to show why functional testing sometimes are brittle, because it depends on the layout, but that's precisely some of the things that you are testing, right? But in this case, because it is marked as stepwise, it failed on the second method. It didn't even call the third one because it knows that the state will probably won't be right.
Okay.
So it saves time. It makes your builds a bit faster because it doesn't run tests that shouldn't be run.
Mm-hmm.
How it knows that login page is on that address? Because you write when at login page, when to login.
Yeah, because we're moving into index page.
Oh, index page.
Yes, exactly. Because the way that this Jeff and Grails works is that when the application bootstraps and is ready, there's always a base URL, and Jeff points to that base URL at the beginning, the default index page, and that's where we begin.
Nice.
Yeah. So this one makes it very easy. There are more things that I can show you about Spark, but I'll say that being able to be very explicit on what you want to say on the method name, using data tables, using blocks to separate from definitions and set up a stimulus, and well, actually stimuli, and assertions is pretty cool. There is mocking support, and it's also very, very nice. It's inspired by Mockito, if I'm not mistaken, and some others. But you can also mock abstract classes and concrete
mocking
classes.
Mocking is very nice with this shift operator.
Mm-hmm.
It looks a bit weird at first, but it's very nice afterwards.
I think I have an example in AsciiDoctor.
Yeah. One problem we had just when you wrote all the stuff that came back to me is we wanted these nice reports because, I mean, yeah, you want also this given when then it should be somehow so nice, it should be showable to the business also. And there's this Spock report plugin.
Yes.
In Maven. we used Maven for this project, and that gave us a bit of trouble. I wonder what the state or this or the recommendation is, whether we should use Gradle or maybe as a, maybe the plugin is already fixed. It was a bit awkward to use this thing. If I remember correctly, it depends on the Shofire output and parses the XML again and does some. It seemed a bit brittle, and I ended up forking it on GitHub and putting a known version on our Maven repo. And a couple of weeks back, I got a mail from this project colleagues. What I did do there, something was broken, I don't remember. So this was a bit. Everything else was very fine, but something was unbroken. If you had mixed, for example, if you had mixed text. Mixed tests, if Shofire would execute normal unit tests and Groovy specs or Spock specs, then it would choke on the output of the normal unit test.
Maybe because it would be different.
Yeah.
I know, so I haven't looked into that particular plugin, but I know that the author, Pedro Nidivisa, he's. The reason why he's holding back releasing 1.0, because it's pretty much already there. One, is finish up documentation so there is the best documentation that you can find, and second, the reporting. He was working on an additional reporting feature for Spock that will make the make it easy for you to read what is out there. Now, if this thing will output some kind of behavior-driven development report when you only see the descriptions of this block and whatnot, probably.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's working on it. The other tool that I know that provides this thing is called ECB.
ECB.
ECB.org is a JBehave inspired Groovy based framework for testing Java and Groovy. And this particular tool allows you to write tests in this way exactly, like given, when, then. But you give an additional comment on each one of these blocks. And when you run these tests, it generates two reports. One is kind of the standard JUnit report, when you see the times and which fail, what not. And the other is a textual report that contains only the descriptions of the scenarios and the messages on the given when then. So this is the natural language that the stakeholders will use to define the scenarios. So in a sense, kind of like Cucumber, but keeping everything in just one file.
Okay.
Cucumber requires two files.
Yeah.
The specification, which is natural language, and the implementation, which uses regular expressions to match whatever you want to do. And ECB just keeps one single file. I think that's a good thing. But what I wanted to show here in the SPAC is, in this particular case, I have a mock object. And this mock object within the dem block, again, this is where the assertions are implicit. What we're seeing here is a number 2 multiplying the mock, calling a method called render file, and inside render file, the call to render file, there are 2 underscores. This render file takes 2 arguments, but if I put an underscore in the Spock, it means I don't care about which value, so fill it in with anything you want to. Something that matches the type, but I don't care what it is. You can use the underscore for the method name. So in that sense, you're saying I want to call any method on that particular mock. You can, if you have multiple mocks, you can also use the underscore for the mock. So you say, I don't care which mock you are, this particular method is called. I can use regular expressions to match method names. So if you want to match, if any getter has been called, just use get and dot star.
But it only select one. That one is okay, it goes further. If there are more mocks with that render file, for example, it will run only one, not every that has render file.
Yeah. And when we're saying with this number multiply the invocation, is that there should be 2 invocations of the render file on this mock. If there were to be less or more, there will be a failure. There are more invocations than expected. I could also specify what is the real argument. If the first argument must be a file and that file must be this specific one, I can say so. or in this case I don't care, I just want to see if that method was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
There are more things that you can do with mocks. Here's another thing. The mock ASCII doctor render file, I don't care the arguments, and then use the rightshift operator with a closure. Whenever this method is called, then I expect this exception that is inside that closure to be thrown. If that exception is not thrown, then I have a failure in my test case.
Mm-hmm.
That's another way, another syntax to show that. So that's basically it. Here I'm more explicit mocking. There is a 1+ render file with a specific directory. There is another 1+, so this means in this order and this order. And then there's a 0+ mock ASCII.render file. So there should be only two calls to render file, one of them with this value, the other one with this value. And if there were to be any other calls to render files, this would be an error. And so this is a strict mocking. Yeah, this one is, this particular tool called ASCII Doctor is a Ruby-based implementation of ASCII Doc. ASCII Doc is a text format for writing documentation.
Mm-hmm.
ASCII Doctor is a re-implementation of that using Ruby and then ported to Java using JRuby. And this project is the Gradle ASCII Doctor plugin for it. So you can run it with any Java project. You can write your source, your documentation in ASCII Doc, which is very rich. We're also tiny, so you don't have to learn a lot of things, and then you're good to go. There is a Maven plugin for ASCII Doctor. Well, this is the counterpart Gradle plugin.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if you said before if that tool can use. What if on the page, in the previous login page? The page is generated using JavaScript. It will be working. It depends on the browser. That it uses browser in the background, or how it's working.
My gut feeling says that it should work, because once the page has been rendered by the browser that you have configured in the web driver, then you have access to the DOM.
It is possible to run it without. Integration with normal browser. Is there some WebKit browser that can be integrated without using the Windows or something?
Yeah, that's the one that I used. It's a HTTP unit. It's a faceless browser.
I was not aware. And it runs JavaScript.
Yes, HTTP unit is capable of running JavaScript.
Nice, I
can see all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the other tool that people are being aware of right now is Gradle, which I already mentioned. And in my mind, there are many advantages to switching to Gradle. Even if this is, if you happen to work in a standard, plain, bare bones Java project that uses Maven, switching to Gradle means that your build file is smaller. Let me show that. I believe I have an example of that.
Let me, before we change, one quick question before, because we are about to set up some testing for the GWT Vadim-based web application. Do we have any, or are there any pitfalls which would prevent
Spark and Vadim?
Really, probably not. No, it's more than the web driver type. Spark works for sure, but I'm more interested in the web driver and the.
I'm afraid I wouldn't know. No.
Okay.
I haven't played too much with web driver in order to figure out, and definitely not with Vadim.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry about that.
No, you can't know anything, but it might have. incident. Everything.
I have something. I think it's in this other place, this other directory. There is a sample Gradle project.
Mm-hmm.
It's presentations we work on, what is it? Gradle. Yes, here we go. It's going to first wait. So here I have a standard Java project which follows the Maven convention, so it means the source code is in under source main Java, and then you have source test Java and source main resources and whatnot. And there's no POM file. Okay, here are the sources. Believe they're in source main Java. There's also a file called first Java, which is a simple bean that has a method, do it, and prints out something. Okay. Now, because it is a standard Java-based project, the Gradle build file turns out to be a single line, like this, apply plugin Java. What? Because, well, we know the conventions. That's one thing that bothers me with Maven. It gave us conventions. It gave us plugins. Mm-hmm. But you still have to specify some of those basic conventions in the POM file, even if you're following the happy path. Configuring a plugin, it's a few lines of code. Whether you like XML or not, it's just a few lines of code, more than just a single line, at least in this case. So what you actually see on a Gradle build file is how your build deviates from a standard. In our case, this project does not deviate in any way. Just applying the plugin Java give us the right thing to do. Now this is not enough for testing because we haven't defined any dependencies for testing, but at least compiling the thing, building the thing, creating a jar is enough. So if I go into the command line for this project and say controller Gradle.
I mean, to be fair, what you would need to specify in Maven is mainly the group ID, artifact ID.
Group ID, artifact ID, version ID, probably developers, SCM, dependencies.
You can leave this off.
Yeah, that's additional metadata.
Yeah.
But when we start getting into plugins and dependencies, then you start seeing the thing grow and grow and grow. And then you might configure reporting plugins.
I mean, you only need to configure the Java plugin if you don't want to use Java 1.5 or whatever is the standard. And I guess in normal Gradle script, you would also need to specify which Java source version you are.
As a property, yes.
But I mean, the main thing is, of course, the syntax is much nicer than XML.
It's definitely much nicer for that XML.
But for that we are.
I have a saying from a friend, Scott Davis. Why do roses have thorns? To protect themselves. And if you grab a rose, I mean, barehanded, then you will hurt yourself because it has pointy things. What else has pointy things? XML. So if you hold it closer to yourself, then you will hurt yourself. So don't do that. So here I cleaned the build, so we see the different phases that it went through. Some of those phases claim to be up to date, means that it didn't have to do anything because there's nothing to process. In this case, there are no resources, so it didn't process the resources. There are no tests, so it didn't process. Now I'm going to run Gradle build again, and I haven't changed any code. The build time should be now faster. Previously it was 8.071 seconds, and now it's 1.347 seconds. Pretty much every phase was skipped because nothing changed.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. So if I add a dependency, then it will recompile because it will figure out, hey, you might need it. And if I change a single line of code, then it will recompile it. So it's smart enough. The next thing where Gradle shines is multi-project builds. And this is really, really cool. Let's call it multi. And inside multi, I have two projects here. One is called multi-core, and the other called is multi-ext. Extension will depend on core, so there is a sibling dependency. And there is a master project file. So in the sense, in Maven, you have a master POM. Define the modules, and each one of the modules will have a dependency on its parents. And when you have dependencies within siblings, the reactor sometimes doesn't get it right, especially when you have transit disasters. The case is you have projects A, B, and C as siblings.
Mm-hmm.
A depends on C depends on B, and B depends on A. You're currently working on C. Make a change on A and compile the project from within C. What should happen is that Maven should see that the A project
step up
and recompile A.
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't do it, and just compile C, and then you may be in trouble. Gradle is smart enough to figure that out and recompile A before compile C. So it has a much richer object model for your project. So it's able to know these dependencies. So in the main project file, where is it? There we go. This guy defines what could be common to all the projects and also what is unique to this root project. What is unique to this root project is just the definition of a new task, this task called hello. If you call Gradle hello, we'll print out hello because that's exactly what we see in this code. And what we see in this block, we're saying for all sub-projects, I'm going to apply the Groovy plugin and the Maven plugin so that I can publish the jars, the artifacts for these sub-projects as Maven artifacts into Maven local, or if I have the right credentials, into a remote Maven repository. I also define in the repository sections that any dependency should be resolved against Maven Central, which is the default for any POM. So yes, here we have one more line, but then you have the capability to define any other repositories. And also, every single subproject has a dependency on the Groovy, on this particular Groovy version. So Groovy core, the build file, I believe will be a surprise because it's empty. There's nothing for this particular sub-project that deviates from what the parent set. So, empty, but it has to be there, build.groovy. And from the extension project, what I'm saying is that there should be a dependency within core and extension. So that's exactly what, this, the only thing that I see in the extension is I am depending on multicore, which is a sibling, and here's the syntax for defining dependencies on something else. I'm just finding syntax for common slang, but it could be anything else. We're almost out of time. So if I run this thing, do a Gradle clean build from the root, compile core first, and then extension. I don't have network, so yeah, it will take some time to resolve, but it will compile extension. So if then later I'm within extension, say multi-XT, make some change to core and start the compilation from here, it will recompile core first and then continue with the extension.
Yeah, that's different to Maven.
That's different to Maven. That you can be in any subtree, and as long as a Maven is a valid Gradle project, you invoke a command there. There's also a syntax, so if you find a child project and I want to invoke a task on the root project, you can do so without changing directory. So as long as Gradle said it's smart enough to figure out, oh, I'm within a multi-project build, so if I call a command here in this branch, then I should find that task in this particular project, sub-project. But if it's not found, then it's an error. If I give it the right syntax to go up another level or from a sibling invoke a task from another sibling, then that also possible. This is one of the reasons why I like Gradle.
Yeah.
I try to do some Gradle stuff, but I have a strange look of the projects, sub-projects and so on. But I have one person from the GUI side and one for the others and so on. And I wanted one sub-project to compile it only when it's needed, and only that GUI. But others shouldn't be compiled, and I guess hierarchical structure is, and I cannot explain that now because it was 2 months ago when I tried to do that, and unfortunately Gradle was not able to do that, to compile only without that root root project, compile only sub project without getting data from the, getting sources from a repository of the root. It was unfortunately not good for the grader that I had. And I posted a message on the Gradle site and the developer said it's not currently possible in the
Gradle. I see.
Yeah, but I hope that in some future it will be done.
And possible.
Okay, now it's possible when you write your own Ruby code, but there's way something to do in the Gradle to be even better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Gradle guys are always looking for feedback and to make the thing better. So, if you find something that is not working for you, is not explaining correctly, is missing documentation, just let those guys know and they'll figure out something.
And the, I was, I feel strange when that new version of Gradle is very fast released, so my code from 1.4 can be deprecated in 1 year or something. That can be, I think that maybe not the greater, but every 2 months or some
yes.
new release, I feel, oh, my code is, I had to rewrite it because there are some new features that could be used. And I'm aware that I need to wait when it will be more stable in the development. I'm
mm-hmm.
not sure how do you feel with that, but
It used to be slow and now it's quite fast. The shortest release cycle is 6 to 7 weeks between final candidates. And they, for some reason, the Gradle team decided to be that fast. But I think they will eventually come up with a slower speed. You are not really required to upgrade to the latest Gradle unless you want to test some feature. I am running the latest Gradle because they claim it's the fastest one, because how they manage the caching of dependencies is really much, much faster. I will need this because I have huge builds. But if I didn't need that, if I were just standard builds, then it's fine to still stick with Gradle 1.5 or even 1.6.
And I like that build end. And I can build XML from end. And I only write one line of code and I can compile old stuff in new way.
Yeah.
So it's very nice.
Yeah, you can integrate ant builds in Gradle.
It's slower, but it's worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I can increment the change that is compiled to Gradle.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. I think that we're out of time now, so we have to go back to the main room. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Glad you enjoyed.
Great overview.